Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie.
And I am Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 41 through 45 of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
We're in the end game now.
Thank you, Doctor Strange.
I know, I couldn't resist.
So much is happening. It's happening.
These are my favorite chapters of the book.
They were so much fun.
Yeah, these are the best. It's like...
Yeah.
No, I didn't have a thought.
It's just the best.
Yeah.
So we've talked about before how I'd never really read the books until now, but I've always like consumed so many of the adaptations. A lot of this stuff isn't in a lot of what we've seen on screen. Mm-hmm. Like so much of it. It was crazy. It was fun to have new stuff for me, but a lot of it seemed important too. So I'm kind of sad that I've missed out on it all this time.
Yeah. I mean, even me, like I've read these books like at least once a year since high school, and I'm still kind of rereading them, these chapters, and maybe I'm influenced by the adaptions also, but there was a lot in here I was like, oh my god, like what? That's the thing that happened. But no, it's been really fun to sort of close read it.
Before we get to that though, why don't you catch us up on what you've been doing that isn't Austen related, I guess, as if anything exists.
I mean, everything can be connected back to Austen. But yeah, I feel like rich in books right now. Like I ordered all these books that we had discussed in our recommendations episode. Mm-hmm. And I have like all my library holds have kind of come up at the same time. So I feel like very blessed in this moment. So I've been like churning through books. And first I read The Children of Blood and Bone and the sequel Children of Vice and Virtue series that we spoke about. And it gave me, like, all the magical feelings. It has, like, everything I love in YA fantasy. Like, love interests, love triangles, people who should be together, who shouldn't be together, but I want them to be together even though they're, like, not in healthy relationships. friendship, magical powers, really great world building, and a main character with flaws, but who you also want to root for. So if you like fantasy, if you like Harry Potter, if you like any of those like magic fantasy type books, like I highly recommend this series. The second one ends in like a cliffhanger though, so be careful because you're gonna be very mad and you're gonna be like, when is the next book coming out?
Do you know when there's next book coming out?
I'm not sure. You know how Goodreads sometimes like puts up book three, you know, but then there's no like release date, like projected 2021 or something like that.
That's just cruel.
I know it is, so I'm guessing in like the next year or so. So hopefully, cross our fingers, because it's really good. And the cliffhanger, you're like, what? Like, what? Yeah. Yeah, these books are really good. And then I also churned through Get a Hint, Danny Brown, and Party of Two by Jasmine Gilroy. Danny Brown is a sequel to Chloe Brown, which we also spoke about. And these are both, like, romance novels. Danny Brown has my favorite trope in it, which is, like, fake dating. But it does it in a way that's very kind of a little bit more grown up, and it's never really contrived, and the characters are really smart, and they also grow a lot in the book. So, you know, sometimes fake dating can be a lot of cliches and you can kind of get frustrated with the characters, but they go about it in a really kind of grown up way in the book that I appreciated. And it's very sexy too.
Always helps.
Yeah. And then Party of Two might be my favorite Gilroy book since The Wedding Date. The main character, Olivia, moves from LA to New York in order to start her own law firm. And at a hotel bar where she's staying, she runs into a very attractive man who shares her dessert preferences. And he also turns out to be California's very attractive junior senator. I know. And I want to like live in the universe of this book and hang out with Olivia and Max every day. And they eat like tons of dessert in the book, and they like describe like the chocolate cakes and stuff. So I was like very hungry when I was reading it, but it was very good and highly recommend. So, and I just feel very rich in books right now. We're in a good time for books, I think.
It sounds like it.
Which makes sense because you can publish books in a quarantine easier than other content.
I'm sure. No, in theory, I was going to read a lot more books during lockdown times, but ooh, just real life and everything. I haven't been lucky enough to just take more time to chill and read books. A lot of just like lying down and watching a lot of comfort TV and everything. But those sounds so good.
No, it's hard. I mean, either like I think that it's like two extremes. Like either now is like a really good time to read, or mm-hmm. it's just so hard to focus and you want to do something else. And for me, like I really haven't been reading like mm-hmm. intellectual books, or, you know, I mean, I don't want to like there's nothing wrong with romance novels. I mean, I love them, but they've been like fun reads.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not reading like the dictionary or anything.
I don't I would start to question and worry about you if you ever did.
Yeah. It'd be hard to link that back to Jane Austen, actually.
She has some very good words.
Oh, she does have good words. But anyway, I could go on and on. What have you been like reading?
Yeah. So, I mean, same thing. It's not, I'm not exactly like picking through anything too mentally taxing. Not to say that anything has, any of these things are to be trifled with or anything, but they just like scratch a different itch. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the ones that you mentioned were already on my list anyways. I think I own one or two of them already. Maybe I'll just wait until the third Children of Blood book and Bone book comes out before I finally just get down to it. So I think last time we talked about Sin Eater, which was really interesting, and I was very curious to see where it was going, but I've kind of put it on the back burner again because my mind just went, this is so much, and the language is just a little different. It's a little more like Elizabethan times. So my brain just went, we'll try again later. Hopefully we actually do go back to that. We being me and my brain. But I did pick up Alyssa Cole's That Could Be Enough. I know we talked about that in the past. Mm-hmm. It's a story. It's like set in post-American Revolutionary times. It's got at its center a queer black female couple. One of them is actually from like Eliza Hamilton's orphanage and is her secretary. And the other one is a seamstress. And it's just a nice, simple romance with some misunderstandings and two seemingly very attractive people finding each other attractive. So that was fun. That one, speaking of feast or famine, that one I actually just like knocked out in a day and just enjoyed myself. It was like a breezy, sexy, lovely read. And then like a week later, Hamilton came out. So that was fun.
Oh, yeah. Your excuse to take a reading break to watch Hamilton. This is me giving everyone listening permission.
The people living with me when I watched it were just like, this is a really long show. I'm like, yeah, it is. Just chill.
Oh, my God. It. Let it wash How over dare you. They? It should be like longer.
This is what happens when everyone, you know, is like supremely ADD. Mm-hmm. I did also excitingly start A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor by Hank Green. He's been my only male cishet white author of the year, and I've been happy to make him my only exception. I read this book is actually the sequel to An Absolutely Remarkable Thing. That book was his very first novel. His brother is the, you know, acclaimed YA author John Green. Very different tones and a lot of fun. The first one really kind of dealt with internet fame, notoriety, and the global community, which was and it was really interesting. So I've been very excited to catch this sequel, which just came out last week. And so far, I am enjoying it. It kind of left on a little cliffhanger in the first one, too, with like, she's dead. Is she? Oh. So we're exploring it from her friends and girlfriend's perspective. And it's just fun. I can't wait to see where it's going to go, because the reviews have said that it is weirdly relevant for like these current times in the political and societal temperature right now. And it's going to be good. I'm excited.
You know, I've never, those books weren't really on my radar. I mean, I've heard of them, but they weren't on any of my, like, to-read lists or anything. But now I'm kind of curious. So you did a good sell.
Awesome. It took a couple pages for me to get into the first one, but I think that was just more me than a book thing. But I was really surprised at where it went and all the different ideas that the first one explored. So I think it'll be a very pleasant surprise for you. You know, a male or John Green, like, or Hank Green, like I said, he's, you know, cishet white male, but a fairly thoughtful individual. If you've ever seen any of his videos on YouTube, I've been a bit of a fan for the past like 10 years off and on. And so it's been good. It's I've not been let down yet, but it's still early days.
All right.
Yeah. And I've also been I just started Michaela Cole's I Will Destroy You, which is on HBO Max, or just regular HBO in the two. She became fairly known for a show she did previously called Chewing Gum. She's this like fantastic writer and actress person. And this one, I will say there is like kind of a content warning going on there where sexual assault is a major plot point. So, you know, keep that in mind with you as you go. But I'm really appreciating how that's being approached. I think it's like emotionally and mentally realistic, and just the relationships and characters are really, really likable so far. So it's currently a recommend. All good things so far.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I don't have HBO Max, I don't think. So maybe
you have a regular HBO? I think it's on regular HBO.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I have regular HBO. It's very confusing, but I get like HBO through my cable provider. So I've been getting like teasing emails about HBO Max, and I'm very unclear whether I have it or not. So we'll see.
They have not been very good at explaining that to us, and I think that message has been lost. Anyways, more good stuff ahead.
So
Jane Austen.
So
always good stuff.
So Annie, you want to let us know what happened previously on our Jane Austen journey in Pride and Prejudice?
After turning down Darcy's ill-tempered and insulting marriage proposal and then subsequently receiving his long letter of explanation, our Elizabeth is still working through her thoughts and feelings, as well as who to believe. While at first wanting to deny everything in the letter, she comes to realize that much of what he says is true and begins to change her view on both Mr. Darcy and Mr. Wickham. Later, she finally leaves Rosings and, after parting, meets up with her younger sisters, who brings news that Mr. Wickham is safe and now available once more. We learn that the militia is about to leave Meryton, much to the dismay of many in the Bennet household, except for Elizabeth, who is pretty happy about it. Jane is still down about Bingley, and Elizabeth decides to share with Jane some of the contents of the letter, but withholds the knowledge that Darcy made sure Bingley didn't know Jane was in London.
Dun, dun, dun.
Darcy is a messy boy.
But, you know, he writes very well. So, thank you, Annie, for that really good previously on. I'm going to recap what happened in the chapters we read for today. So we begin with Lydia being invited to spend the summer in Brighton by the wife of a Colonel Forrester. Mr. Bennet allows her to go, assuming that the Colonel will keep her out of trouble. Elizabeth sees Wickham once more before his regiment departs, and they discuss Darcy in a very guarded manner. Elizabeth avoids any mention of what she's discovered. The soldiers leave Meryton for Brighton, and Kitty is distraught to see them go, and even more distraught that her sister is allowed to follow them. In July, Elizabeth accompanies the gardeners on a tour of the Derbyshire. It's very confusing. Anyway, Derbyshire countryside, and their travels take them close to Darcy's manor, Pemberley. Hearing that Darcy is not in the neighborhood, Elizabeth agrees to take a tour of the estate. As Elizabeth tours the beautiful estate of Pemberley with the gardeners, she imagines what it would be like to be mistress there as Darcy's wife. The housekeeper, Mrs. Reynolds, shows them portraits of Darcy and Wickham and relates that Darcy in his youth was the sweetest, most generous-hearted boy in the world. She adds that he's the kindest of masters and has never heard a cross word from him in her life. Elizabeth is surprised to hear such an agreeable description of a man she considers unbearably arrogant. When Elizabeth and the gardeners continue to explore the grounds, Darcy himself suddenly appears. He joins them in their walk, proving remarkably polite. Elizabeth is immediately embarrassed at having come to Pemberley after the events of recent months, and she assures Darcy that she only came because she thought he was away. Darcy tells her that he's just arrived to prepare his home for a group of guests that includes the Bingleys and his own sister Georgiana. He asks Elizabeth if she would like to meet Georgiana, and Elizabeth replies that she would. After Darcy leaves them, the gardeners comment on his good looks and good manners, so strikingly divergent from the account of Darcy's character that Elizabeth has given them. The next day, Darcy and Georgiana, who's very pretty but also very shy, visit Elizabeth at her inn. Bingley joins them, and after a brief visit, they invite Elizabeth and the gardeners, who perceive that Darcy is in love with their niece, to dine at Pemberley. The following morning, Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardiner visit Pemberley to call on Miss Darcy. Bingley's sisters are both present, and when Darcy enters the room, Miss Bingley makes spiteful comments to Elizabeth, noting that the departure of the militia from Meryton must be of great loss to your family. Elizabeth dodges the subject of Wickham. This deflection proves fortunate given the presence of Georgiana, as it references to the man with whom she almost eloped and would most certainly embarrass her. After the guests depart, Miss Bingley attempts to criticize Elizabeth to Darcy and makes a light remark about how he once thought Elizabeth was rather pretty, and then he says he now considers her one of the most handsomest women of his acquaintance. So much drama.
Take that, Caroline.
Oh, it's so good. So juicy. So restrained.
It's like low-key sassy. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite kind of Austin. Thank you for that.
Yeah. No, it was so... These chapters were so good. Like, my favorite... Some of my favorite stuff is in here.
So, in Sense and Sensibility, there was just, like... I feel like there were a lot of chunks of chapters that were so fully loaded of stuff. And it was kind of imbalanced. You know, like, a lot of info that wasn't that was important to the plot but not actually part of the plot at the beginning, and then like a whole bunch of stuff at the end, and then like a little clump in the middle where something happened. But I feel like it's been pretty well paced throughout and building up, and not to say that things haven't been happening before, but it is like we're at a gallop now and we're only going faster. How do you feel about all this?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think when I remember distinctly when I first read these books that the time between Darcy's proposal and being rejected and then her, Elizabeth arriving at Pemberley was almost unbearably long because I just wanted them to like be together and be flirty and banter more. But upon reflection and further readings, I think that that period of time is really important because Elizabeth is able to re-examine a lot of her thoughts and feelings about Wickham and about Darcy, and Darcy is able to kind of do the same. So they do take a personality. There is a change in personality, but it's really earned, and it's through sort of growth. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in both of them. And these chapters really make that clear, which is really refreshing. Because, you know, it could be if they'd rushed, if Austen had rushed it and they hadn't had that period of reflection, it wouldn't have seemed as well earned, I think.
No, I totally agree. That's a really good point, because I feel like even for as many of the adaptions I do like, it does tend to skip that a lot. It does when, I mean, and they do try to do the work, you know, early on and try to build the sort of obvious attraction, but the internal work that it takes for them to get there, not necessarily work, because, you know, like to turn back and look at themselves and reexamine everything, it's interesting, and it makes everything less like frivolous, I guess, or less flighty. It's actually based on real things, as opposed to just like we have showed up at his home and it's really big.
And when you think, and especially in the beginning of these chapters, you have a really interesting juxtaposition between Lydia's relationship with the officers and Elizabeth's relationship with Darcy, because Lydia is sort of the girlish and flighty, to borrow your word, example of, you know, whirlwind romance. Like, I'm going to go to Brighton, I'm going to catch myself an officer, and I'm going to be pretty and young and flighty and enjoy myself. And then you have Elizabeth, who's very much more reserved. And even when she liked Wickham, right, she was still reserved. So you have this picture of someone who's much more mature, and the romance with Elizabeth and Darcy is so much slower, but also so much more full of growth and introspection. And that's really obvious when compared directly toward Lydia and how she views relationships.
Oh, that's a really good point, too.
And these are the chapters, too, where there's like a diversion with the parents, right? You have like a little bit of a blurb about, I mean, we're jumping ahead here, but about Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Bennet and how he sort of jumped into that relationship and they ended up in a romance that was not very good.
It was just all based on like very, it's seemingly immediate feelings and not anything more, which is a story. Again, another thing that doesn't often get included in the adaptations. I mean, understandably because of like length, but it does answer questions that I think a lot of people would have about them. And it is a nice contrast from what it seems to be building to, which is like Elizabeth and Darcy actually examining not just like the people that they are individually, but how they feel about that person and how they get along and what is important to them, as opposed to like, hey, you're like super hot.
Yeah.
Which is important.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Even Austen is like, they're all very attractive.
I do enjoy how much she points that out. And we are getting more increasing moments of like, isn't Mr. Darcy's face just so nice?
Yeah, which is important in a book, even though like I'm picturing Colin Firth the entire time.
That's fine. That's super fine. Yeah. I don't think that there's anyone who would complain about that at all.
So sort of jumping back towards the beginning of these chapters, we have Lydia being asked to go to Brighton with her particular friend and Kitty being mad about it. And you have Elizabeth going to her father and saying, don't, like, I think what is the, I wrote down one of the quotes, our importance and our respectability in the world must be affected by the wild validity and the assurance and disdain of all restraint which mark Lydia's character. If you, my dear father, will not take the trouble of checking her exuberant spirits and of teaching her that her present pursuits are not to be the business of her life, she will soon be beyond the reach of amendment. Her character will be fixed, and she will, at 16, be the most determined flirt that had ever made her and herself and her family ridiculous. Which is a lot.
It's so interesting because Elizabeth loves her father. She clearly worships him and thinks very highly of him and sees a lot of commonality between the two of them. But I love that she's just like, this is where you're being a bad dad.
Yeah. And we've been told a bunch of times that her dad, you know, she's her father's favorite and that he respects her opinion. But here we see him just totally dismiss her, you know, because he doesn't want to deal with Lydia, basically. He's like, you know, who cares? Like, Colonel Foster's a sensible man. Like, we're not going to have any peace if she doesn't go to Brighton. Like, that's his main objective, is to have peace at home. So even though he has, like, the daughter that he most trusts and values her opinion, he's just completely dismissive of it because he wants to just have peace and not deal with it.
And up until now, like, he said and done things that you're kind of like, I don't know how I feel about that. But he's also presented as a very intelligent, very charming, if not really like sardonic sort of fellow. And I really appreciate that even Elizabeth is coming to this moment where she's like, you know, this is probably something I'm going to disagree with. And this is why. And I agree with her.
And you know, we also have Elizabeth knowing that, you know, Jane lost out on her, you know, soulmate or whatever because of sort of the family. And so Elizabeth has this piece of knowledge that, granted, their father doesn't. But even he sort of, like, dismisses it. He says, wherever you and Jane are known, you must be respected and valued. And you will appear to less advantage for having a couple, or may I say, three very silly sisters. So even her father touches on it, you know, like, whatever, like, you guys are well known and respected, like, who cares about having three silly sisters, even though that does actually matter, because Jane did sort of lose out on Bingley's affection because of how the family appeared. So it's sort of even salt in the wound, I guess. Like, it's even more cruel.
It is. It really is. What was I going to say? I can't find the quote anymore. But at some point, like, he even sort of sarcastically makes fun of Elizabeth for being like, oh, who are all these men that you have lost out on because of your association with Lydia? Come on. Bring them in. We'll talk to them. And it's so dismissive.
What, is she frightened away some of your lovers? Poor little Lizzie, which is so condescending and horrible.
It is. And this whole time, we've always seen him, like, respecting her and almost being the one that he sees as an equal. But even now, he's just putting her back down, kind of reminding her she's just the daughter. He's the dad.
Ugh. It's a little, like, foreshadowy, too. Like, you know, like, shit's going to go down in Brighton. Like, it has to at this point. So it's just sort of like, it's a very cringy scene, and it makes me, like, uncomfortable. Because I do like her father, and I like their relationship, and it's, like, an important part in the novel. But here he's just downright rude and condescending to her, which is, like, sort of a rough read.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that this, like, loving, sort of idealized relationship is showing its flaws and that Elizabeth is recognizing it, which I think is, like, really appropriate for, how old is she supposed to be? Like, 21-ish, 20? That's the age where that really starts happening, I think, at least in my experience, when you start thinking, oh my God, I'm daddy's little girl. But at the same time, like, daddy's kind of dumb sometimes and I'm going to disagree with him and I'm going to be able to voice it because I know I'm right.
No, that's a really good point that, like, this is sort of showing, like, growth in the relationship between her and her father, and her sort of questioning it. Even, like, she clearly knows who, like, what kind of person her father is, but she, like, idolizes him, and she thinks that he's the fact that she voices these concerns to him means that she thinks that he might consider them, right? You know, if she thought that he would be dismissive of her, then she would never even brought these concerns up. But no, like, he just, like, demeans her and is kind of condescending to her, and Lydia gets to go to Brighton.
It's disappointing. I was in a group watch of the 2005 Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice, and there was someone who was just really, really fighting for Mr. Bennet's side, and actually talked about how, and I texted you about it afterwards, about how actually he's being, well, they'd been defending him throughout the whole thing anyways, but they're like, he's actually being a good father right now because he's giving Lydia freedom. I was like, I think that would be fine if Lydia were some mm-hmm. a different person. But I think you're ignoring the kind of person that Lydia is. Just a very flighty, sort of dreamy, overly excited, unaware 15-year-old.
I mean, like, listen, I, you know, we're supposed to like Mr. Bennett, especially at first, because he's funny and sarcastic mm-hmm. and is someone that has frequently had people read me the wrong way because I am sarcastic. Like, I'm amenable to, you know, having sympathy for him and liking Mr. Bennett. But this scene is just, like, bad. Like, Elizabeth is our, we are Elizabeth, right? Like, most of the book is from her perspective. Like, you know, Elizabeth makes mistakes and she's prejudiced and, you know, whatever. The book is called Pride and Prejudice and she's not perfect. But we're supposed to view her and her opinion quite well. And when she says, mm-hmm. Lydia shouldn't go to Brighton, I think we're supposed to be like, yeah, Lydia shouldn't go to Brighton. Like, I don't, like, there's never a voice in there's never a good reason for her to go. And, like, yeah, like, Elizabeth withholds kind of information. Like, maybe if she had told her father about it, all the reasons why Lydia shouldn't go because of Wickham and Darcy and everything, like, maybe she wouldn't. So it's kind of unfair for us to judge completely Mr. Bennett here. But at the same time, he says, you know, whatever, like, we won't have peace. And that's sort of his main concern.
Yes.
It's not great.
It's not great. Because Elizabeth, for all her flaws and, you know, all her grudges that she's held, she's being surprisingly measured and rational when it comes to Wickham, even though she's maybe too cautious about sharing certain information. But we know that no matter what, her priority will always be taking care of her sisters and the family in general, mm-hmm. not just like, can we make this nice and quiet and peaceful and enjoyable for all of us?
I mean, she withholds information, which isn't great, but I really just don't think that even if she had told her father, like, he would have been like, whatever, Colonel Foster's a respectable man, he'd stop her. Mm-hmm. And it is really sort of Lydia. Like, I think if it was, like, a more measured, responsible, I mean, Lydia's 15. She's a 15-year-old girl. She wants to, like, hang with the officers, like, the handsome officers. I don't blame her. I don't blame her for wanting to go to Brighton.
And she's the youngest one, too.
Yeah, and it's her personality. You know, we know that she's silly and flighty and that she, you know, isn't mature enough yet to make good decisions. We know that, you know, Colonel Foster isn't going to look after her. He's a colonel in the militia, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, the decision to, like, let her go is the issue, not really Lydia wanting to go. I would want to go to Brighton over the summer, you know. I want to go sea bathing. But we also get this really fun scene between Elizabeth and Wickham that's just so guarded.
It's great. And it's, I appreciate having this moment where Wickham realizes, even though they don't ever actually fully acknowledge it, but Lizzie has her moment of being like, I know, dude, I know. Mm-mm. And you see, like, how Wickham has absolutely no foot to stand on and this, like, carefully constructed image he'd been trying to portray and how has now crumbled because it had no foundation whatsoever. And whatever chemistry that they had, now that Lizzie can see past, like, the gorgeous face, there's nothing there, that there's no interaction, and that Wickham knows that he's full of shit.
It's such a great scene because no one is, like, really rude or, like, calls anybody out. It's just very measured. Like, everything that they both say mm-hmm. and is pretty innocuous and not pointed, but it still kind of is. It's just such a fantastic scene. I love, like, all the little looks. She lost all concern for him in finding herself thus selected as the object of such idle and frivolous gallantry. Like, she's pissed, I think, but she still, like, smiles and and uses coded language and doesn't call him out, which you could argue is kind of a problem. You know, he deserves to be just sort of called out, but she takes just, like, this other approach of being like, I know, but I'm not going to say anything, mm-hmm. but don't try your shit with me anymore. Like, I'm on to you and you can stop now, but I'm not going to be rude about it.
He at least has the decency to seem appear a little uncomfortable now that he's been seen, mm-hmm. as opposed to being a complete sociopath being like, all right. So that actually just makes it more fun to know that he's kind of squirming there as she just smiles around, you know, and looks at him like, I know.
And it's such a good indication of the way that Elizabeth's feelings towards Darcy have changed, too. So it kind of clues you in as a reader, like, okay, not only is she wise to Wickham's bullshit, but she's also, you know, I don't think it's just for Wickham's benefit that she's like, no, you know, I think Darcy approves on acquaintance, you know, I understand him more. What I said, when I said that he improved on acquaintance, I did not mean that either his mind of his or his manners were in a state of improvement, but that from knowing him better, his disposition was better understood. It's just such a great quote because it doesn't, it signals to Wickham that she knows the real story and that she's mm-hmm. on Darcy's team. And it signals to us, to the reader, like, okay, you know, this isn't just to get back at Wickham. This is to indicate to us that she's sort of changed her thoughts towards Darcy and, mm-hmm. It's just, I love this interaction. It's very coded. And, you know, the quotes are good, but they're not juicy, really, because it's just such a benign interaction that shuts, like, Wickham down in such a cool way.
Can't argue with it. She can't, or he can't argue with it at all. She knows who he is, and it's not like she's now lost in that sort of, like, weird illusion she had of Wickham. She's like, I know the real person. He can be not my fave, but... he, like you said, she sees the heart of him. She sees what all that is, not like, oh, he's different on the inside.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And then, although Wickham does still try to, like, mm-hmm. get one last jab in and mentions, you know, he does, like, seem to try to bring up what happened with him again and, like, strongly mentions, you know, Darcy's supposed match with Mr. Berg. And meanwhile, Elizabeth, it's like the power of having the truth, mm-hmm. knowing the truth and being okay with that and not needing to prove anything, because she's just like, he already asked me to marry him.
Yeah, so. That's true. Oh,
God, keep trying, Wickham. Keep trying.
I forgot that. I don't know why. It's such like an important moment, but I was like, yeah. And you're like, yeah, he proposed to her. I was like, oh, my God, he did propose to her.
It's this one awesome little card she has in her back pocket where she's just like, you can keep doing what you want because I know the truth. And that. He's super in love with me.
Yeah. And Wickham has no other play here than to double down. He has to just be like, well, you know, he's going to be with Mr. Berg. And she's like, mm-hmm, sure he is. And this last line, like, slays me. They parted at last with mutual civility and possibly mutual desire of never meeting again. It's so good.
I think that's fair and probably would be more beneficial to Wickham if he never sees Elizabeth again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, like, this is sort of, like, she's sort of giving him one last chance here, whether he deserves it or not. She's basically saying, like, I'm not going to out mm-hmm. you. I'm going to, like, pretend that none of this happened, but I'm not going to give you any more of my attention. So it's very cold, ice cold.
It's great. He's one with everything to lose.
Yeah, it's true. But anyway, he's going to Meriden. We don't have to think about him ever again, right?
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile, everyone is super affected by the fact that, oh, no, this is where we, then we get to all the stuff about the Bennets mm-hmm. and their relationship. It's not happy, it turns out.
Well, her father was captivated by youth and beauty and the appearance of good humor, which youth and beauty generally give, which is a ridiculous sentence.
It's also supremely fair.
Yeah, no, it really does a lot to sort of explain their relationship. And it's funny that it comes mm-hmm. like 2/3 throughout the novel. Like, we've already sort of made up our minds as to the relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Bennet. And then it's like, oh, here we're going to give you some like paragraphs about why they even are married in the first place.
There was something there. But it turns out that they found out too late that they weren't very compatible for each other.
And then are stuck together forever.
Forever. It does explain, you know, his, like, weird relationship with some of the other girls who tend to be more like Mrs. Bennet. And does explain, like, her own singular focus on getting them married to the point of being kind of self-destructive. Like, mm-hmm. what else does she have to focus on other than her own unhappy marriage?
And you get... also sort of some more insight as to how Elizabeth views their relationship and views her father, who she, you know, obviously, like, idolizes. Elizabeth, mm-hmm. however, had never been blind to the impropriety of her father's behavior as a husband. She had always seen it with pain, but respecting his abilities and grateful for his affectionate treatment of herself, she endeavored to forget what she could not overlook. So it's basically saying what we said before, you know, like that... he treats her really affectionately and she's his favorite. So she sort of overlooks a lot of mm-hmm. the not so great parts about her father, even when they're just mm-hmm. like plainly in front of her.
Yeah. And occasionally like pitting the kids against her with his jokes and making her the butt of them, which she actually refers to that behavior as highly reprehensible. But she never felt so strongly as now the disadvantages which must attend the children of so unsuitable a marriage, nor ever been so fully aware of the evils arising from so ill judge a direction of Talents. Talents which, rightly used, might have preserved the respectability of his daughters, even if incapable of enlarging the mind of his wife. She's just basically like, I guess he's a good enough dad, but he could have been better, and he could have been a better husband too, but she just kind of overlooks it because, like, she's not blind to it, which is something, but she is still willing to sort of not address it because, I mean, what else could she do anyways?
Oh yeah, like, her mother has basically said, like, Jane's the pretty one and Lydia and Kitty are my favorites. Mary is whatever. Elizabeth is your father's daughter. So, like, she doesn't really have a choice, I guess. And, you know, what is she going to, like, hate both her parents? Like, she's going to overlook the flaws of one of them so she can be the favorite.
Yeah, just turn to the one who's affectionate to you. It's so sad when we put it out like that.
I know,
that.
And it's even sadder that, like, now her, like, eyes are even more open to it. Like, maybe that, maybe that's why this chapter or these paragraphs are so late in the book. Because in the beginning, we are introduced to Mr. Bennett as this sarcastic and sort of funny guy who likes Elizabeth, and we like Elizabeth, and we find the mother tiring, so we are going to sort of side with Mr. Bennett as well. But now, but the fact that this chapter comes right after Mr. Bennett so glibly, like, pushes Elizabeth's concerns aside about Lydia, so that's maybe, like, why we're getting this now, because Elizabeth as well has to deal with the fact that her father is also one of the reasons why her sister isn't going to get married to the man that she loves, and that it's sort of opening her eyes towards a lot of the things that she's sort of pushed aside.
And just, like, listening to you talk, I'm just sort of thinking of, like, when this book came out, I'm sure there were a lot of women who think the same way of a happy, compatible marriage is probably better than a financially advantageous one, but not many would be so adamant about not getting involved with someone or being engaged to someone who wasn't a good match, or if ever at all. And we know that Jane Austen herself never got married. So I think it also goes a long way in explaining to some people who may not understand why she was willing to turn down Mr. Collins, even why she was willing to turn down Mr. Darcy for all his money and riches and estate, because it wouldn't be a happy marriage, and it's only just going to make things even worse for and unhappier, and that is, like, she'd rather just be destitute, I guess.
Oh my gosh. So you're saying
be passing that on to her kids.
You're saying that Elizabeth is making decisions about her future based on her parents' relationship.
I think so. And there's a part that says that, like, it's a good thing that she's actually, like, seen good marriages, and that her parents aren't the only example of what, like, a domestic life is.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, happiness is possible.
That's some, like, therapy stuff.
It really is.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Like, I really like this chapter because of, like, that small passage opened up so much for me.
Oh, yeah. No, it explains a lot of her decision making and why she maybe isn't as ruthless as Charlotte, and why, like, she found Charlotte's views on marriage kind of so reprehensible, because she had seen what happens and she lived, you know, with what happens when two people who are ill-suited for each other end up married. Oh, my God. Insight. That's really good.
What a book.
What a book. My God. And that's just, like, two paragraphs.
Because it is almost like, otherwise it does seem like, well, this character is way too modern and, you know, I mean, for the time being, like, why does she even think like that? It's so out of left field. And not to say that no one did think like this back then, but I've heard people say that before in the past of, like, I don't understand why she's just so ahead of her time like that. But she's smart. She pays attention. She loves her family, and she sees how much all this incompatibility is hurting her family and is possibly to the point where it's too protective of herself, but she is very protective of herself.
No, yeah, it's almost like a character is making decisions based on her life experiences.
It just adds more depth to our wonderful heroine.
Oh, that's so good. And I also love this chapter because we get the buildup of Elizabeth arriving at Pemberley. So we have...
Oh, God.
I love that you can just, like, visit old houses and, like, tour them in, like, Regency era. You're like, oh, yeah, there's this beautiful house. Let's ask the housekeeper if we can, like, creep around while the people are gone.
It's also a museum. And we get the gardeners back. I love the gardeners. They're everything that Bennett's aren't.
Oh, love the Gardeners. And yeah, and we get this very interesting conversation before we see Pemberley with Elizabeth very much not wanting to go. Elizabeth was distressed. She felt that she had no business at Pemberley and was obliged to assume a disinclination for seeing it. She must own that she was tired of great houses, and after going over so many, she had no pleasure in fine carpets or satin curtains. Mrs. Gardiner abused her stupidly. If it were merely a fine house richly furnished, she said, I would not care about it myself, but the grounds are delightful. They have the finest woods in the country. And Elizabeth is just, like, horrified at the possibility of meeting Mr. Darcy and is, like, blushing.
She blushes.
Yeah. It's like the lady protests too much. You know, like, the more that she, like, doesn't want to go and, like, is just like, okay, you like, want to see his house. We all want to see his house.
It just seems like it's been going to be so awkward. And obviously, she doesn't want to tell the Gardeners why. Mm-hmm. So she can't fight it if she doesn't want to tell them why, because otherwise it's just so, like, she'd have to explain it.
Mm-hmm. But, like, they find out he's not going to be there, and so she's like, okay, fine, we'll go to Pemberley. And in my book, it's, like, the end of volume two. So it's sort of, like, the next chapter, like, literally, in the book.
Things are gonna happen.
Yeah, but I am just, like, when she arrives at Pemberley, it is sort of, like, a new start for the book, and in terms of a romance, because she falls in love with Pemberley before she, like, falls in love with Darcy.
There are so many descriptions about the environment, and, you know, some of it is about the house and how it's, like, a large, handsome stone building standing on well-rising ground. But then, like, on and on she goes about the actual surroundings of the place and the actual grounds. Like Mrs. Gardner said, the natural beauty is so striking and you shouldn't miss out on it. It's standing well on rising ground and backed by a ridge of high woody hills, and in front a stream of some natural importance was swelled into greater but without any artificial appearance. Its banks were neither normal nor falsely adorned. Elizabeth was delighted. She'd never seen a place for which nature had done more, or where natural beauty had been so little counteracted by an awkward taste. They were all of them warm in their admiration, and at that moment she felt that to be mistress of Pemberley might be something.
Ugh, it's such, like, an important moment in the book, really.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be cliche and, like, use, like, an AP English, you know, blah blah blah, but Pemberley's, like, a character in the book, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Elizabeth going to Pemberley is just really a critical step in her relationship with Darcy. The house is clearly representative of the owner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Darcy is described as large and handsome. Like, the building's described as large and handsome. Like, there's a stream of some That's natural awesome. Importance without any artificial appearance. Its banks were nearly formal or falsely adorned. And Darcy's the same way. He's elevated socially, just like his house is elevated physically.
The same way Darcy's not very ostentatious at all. The place isn't ostentatious. It just speaks for itself. It is what it is, and you see the beauty there or you don't.
Sorry, I think you can hear my child crying in the background.
So someone's attending to her. She's not just being
No, ignored. I haven't just left her alone. She's being attended to. Anyway.
She just must be heard.
Yeah. But yeah, so, and, like, I think the house doesn't have any pretense, right? It's just constantly described mm-hmm. as, like, being natural and the natural beauty of it. And this is sort of reminding the reader that, like, Darcy himself doesn't have any pretense. He is what he is. He's rude, you know, on first appearance. Like, this is who he is. And the best part about it is Elizabeth loves the house. Like, she loves the grounds. And it just, like, delights her. And she's, like, not hiding it. And so this is sort of like, okay, like, if you like the house so much, maybe you're gonna like Darcy that much.
Maybe. No satin curtains here.
It's just such an important moment, like, her coming to Pemberley and being like, wow, I could have been the mistress here with these rooms. Like, I might be familiarly mm-hmm. acquainted. I could be hosting my uncle and aunt. And then she, like, backtracks. She does a 180 and she's like, well, Darcy wouldn't, you know, approve of my uncle and aunt. They'd be lost to me and I wouldn't have been able to invite them. And then she says, it's a lucky mm-hmm. recollection because it saved her from something like regret. But then later Darcy meets her uncle and aunt and, like, fawns over them. So it's just sort of a funny moment.
He's so gracious to them. If I'm remembering correctly, and I'm sure you can correct me on this, she assumes that his disapproval of her relations have to do with the Gardeners, with her aunt and uncle, right?
With, like, all of them, yeah.
He doesn't specifically say
no,
especially, you know, your well-off tradesman and uncle. It's just, in general, your family is quite unpleasant.
Yeah, no, it's the Bingleys, who, the sisters, Mrs. Bingley and Miss Hurst, who sort of, like, shit on her relatives, because I think they like interrogate Jane, like, where, like, oh, you have family in London, and she's like, yeah, like, he's a lawyer and he lives on Gracechurch Street or like in Cheapside or something, and they like laugh about it. So it's more the people around Darcy than actually Darcy that comes out and says, like, not only do I hate your immediate family, like, it's even your family that are in London or whatever. So I think Elizabeth is projecting a little bit.
Like, assuming if the Bingleys think that, then he, as a old money aristocrat type person, he'll think the same thing.
Yeah, and she uses it as a shield, because here she's like, and she's brought in front of Darcy's home and falls in love with it and realizes that she could have been, you know, mistress of this place, and the only thing that pulls her back is the thought that she wouldn't be allowed to invite her uncle and aunt there. And so she's like, okay, like, woof, like, almost regretted that for a second. Like, I know we're not really talking about the adaptions, but there's a moment in the Edgar Wright film where Keira Knightley's Elizabeth sees the house for the first time and stands up in the carriage and just, like, laughs at it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, too, because she just looks at it and it's so ridiculous. And I think it could easily look like she's like, wow, he really is rich. This is amazing. But I think it's just her sort of, I appreciate more what's in the book and that she sees how grand it is, but it's not its grandeur. It's the sort of tasteful simplicity in it almost.
And we get like other perspectives on Darcy versus just like the town's, you know, first impressions of him. We get this housekeeper that raised him from when he was a child and just keeps going on and on about how he was so good natured and how he was so lovely and how he's the best master and how no woman could ever be worthy of him. And they just go on and on, and the gardeners are like in shock, like, Elizabeth, you told us that he was this like horrible person. And even Elizabeth's like, yeah, like, maybe I was wrong, I guess.
So his father's office, they kind of kept as it was when he was still alive after his death. That means that that Darcy even allowed like the portrait of Wickham to stay there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, why is Wickham's portrait there?
It was like, at no point did he think, this is mine, even though I really respected and honored my father. At no point was he just like, I'm just going to accidentally lose this one. No, he just leaves it there because he just really looked up and respected his father that much. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really nice detail.
That's a really good point that I had not thought of. Like, why is Wickham's portrait there? Like, oh, because his dad liked Wickham. Oh, that's such that's like such another like point in Darcy's column of like being like a nice guy.
He really is. He's just an honorable dude, if not socially awkward.
Yeah, he's super socially awkward. And I like how the gunners are, the commendation bestowed on him by Mrs. Reynolds was of no trifling nature. What praise is more valuable than the praise of an intelligent servant? Which is like a weird way to phrase it, but is sort of like, yeah, you know, it's like upstairs, downstairs, sort of like Downton Abbey.
These are the people who are paying attention, and it doesn't seem like she's just being blind to who he is. I was thinking about how, you know, when you go on a date with someone for the first time and you see how they interact with like the waitstaff, that's the big... Yeah.
How much does he tip?
Yeah, does he tip? Is he rude to them, even though he doesn't have to be, like, super nice to them? Is he actually pleasant with them? Like, that's one of the good barometers of the kind of person that you're dealing with. Because as rich as he is, he doesn't have to be that nice. But and Mrs. Gardner, not to completely dismiss everything that Elizabeth has said about them, she's still trying to, like, respect what her smart niece has said. And she's like, oh, you know, this doesn't sound like what we know. We had it on good authority that Wickham was like a decent dude. But at the same time, this is starting to sound like a little too legit, and it's hard to reconcile. And I think she knows that Elizabeth knows something.
Yeah, the gardeners are very smart and observant, but they're also very careful. Like, they don't want to like call Elizabeth out, but they're just very kind of sort of poking around and trying to figure it out. Like, okay, like, this is a little bit different than what you told us. And Elizabeth is just like,
Yeah.
And then who shows up but Mr. Darcy? Their eyes instantly met, and the cheeks of each were overspread with the deepest blush. Like, oh my God.
I love that moment so much.
No, it's such a good moment. And Elizabeth is just horrified, like absolutely horrified. The quote, she was overpowered by shame and vexation. Her coming there was the most unfortunate, the most ill-judged thing in the world. How strange it must be to him. In what disgraceful light might it not strike so vain a man? It might seem as if she had purposely thrown herself in his way again. The use of exclamation points here, like how, like,
yes.
It's just so horrifying. She's just horrified.
I love it. like the whole time she's blushing through the whole thing as he's being so civil and polite, and that actually seems to be making it worse for her. That he should even speak to her was amazing, but to speak with such civility and to inquire after her family. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. And then that was kind of it for a bit. And they're like, let's leave. Let's go for a walk.
No. She longed to know what at that moment was passing in his mind, in what manner he thought of her, and whether in defiance of everything she was still dear to him. Like, girl, that is not how you talk about someone that you do not care about.
Yeah, the guy that you are like super sure, you're like, no, I'm not gonna marry him, but you keep thinking about it.
What's he thinking about me? Is he thinking about me now? Does he like me? What is he? It's just very perfect.
And the first half of the book, she wasn't just like disliking him. She did not think about him at all, except for like when Wickham would bring him up and it confirmed all these suspicions she had about him. Mm-hmm. Any affection or attraction she had to him was non-existent in the book. But now, he's just constantly on her mind.
And I like how he's like, well, wait, what do you think of my house? And she's like, oh my God, it's great. And then she takes it back. She's like, well, what if he thinks that like my praising his house makes you? Yeah. She's like second guessing like everything. It's a very cute moment.
It is. Very cute. But instead of just going back to the inn, the gardeners and Elizabeth just decide to take a 10-mile walk around the park to enjoy the scenery.
Oh my God, it's so shady when Mrs. Gardner's like, oh, I'm so fatigued. Elizabeth, your arm is inadequate for my support. Like, I must go to my husband. The fact that the line is in there, it's kind of, whatever. Like, she's tired from her walk. But then it's like, no, the gardeners are definitely on to them. They want to see what happens. They're, like, stirring the pot a little bit.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
But no, how would she totally miss this opportunity to have that handsome man who is clearly into their niece walk with her? And because it is more polite for her to be like, husband, hello, I'm tired. Mm-hmm. Carry me along. Don't put me on our niece. I just keep wanting to say daughter, maybe because I kind of wish that the Gardners were the parents that Elizabeth had.
And I know, right? And Darcy, you know, is like so polite and well behaved and unassuming, and then he wants to introduce her to his sister, which is a big moment, I think.
And this is already after he was super chatty with Mr. Gardner and offered to let him fish on the grounds and even said, hey, if you need some supplies, we got stuff.
Oh, it's so great.
It does make it sound like he means when you come to Pemberley again, I'd like you to meet my sister.
But then he's like, I'm going to bring her to the inn that you're staying at like immediately. Like, I need you to meet her right away.
Away. And Elizabeth knows that, like, look, I mean, even before that happens, Elizabeth knows that if his sister wants to meet her or is willing to meet her, the only thing that she would know about her is what Darcy tells her. So obviously, despite everything that's happened between them, he still is very nice about her. He's not saying anything ill.
Mm-hmm. I would say all Elizabeth's anger against him had long done away, but had she still felt any, it could hardly have stood its ground against the unaffected cordiality with which he expressed himself on seeing her again. So she's like, even if I was angry with him, like, there's no way I could even be that angry in front of him because he's just being so mm-hmm. wonderful and nice.
This is like a really nice thing. She was not uncomfortable, or Elizabeth was not comfortable. That was impossible. I like that line. Mm-hmm. But she was flattered and pleased. His wish of introducing his sister to her was a compliment of the highest kind. And as we know, Elizabeth loves her sisters. Darcy loves his sister. That's obviously a match made in heaven.
No, and we get to meet the we haven't met Miss Darcy yet. We've only like heard about her from Wickham, who's basically called her like super proud and super, you know, awful. And so we don't really have a super positive sense of her. But then we meet her, and Elizabeth, you know, said she had heard that Miss Darcy was exceedingly proud, but the observation of only a few minutes convinced her that she was only exceedingly shy. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of like her brother.
And despite their what all the gardeners have heard, despite all that,
my child is not being tortured right now, I promise.
Despite all of what the gardeners heard about Mr. Darcy, even they're like, look, we taking in from what the housekeeper says and from our own experience with him, to be sure, Lizzie, he is not so handsome as Wickham, or rather, he has not Wickham's countenance, for his features are perfectly good. And this is like, just, it's Mrs. Gardner just keeping it real. He has no ill-natured look. Is that what the line says? I feel like I wrote that wrong. On the contrary, there is something pleasing about his mouth when he speaks.
You know, we've sort of like intimated that you know, there's a lot of stuff in the books that doesn't really come across in the adaptions that are just really lovely. And I think for me, mm-hmm. in these chapters, it was really just how wise the gardeners, like how obvious it is that Elizabeth and Darcy, or especially that Darcy, like, loves Elizabeth still. And we don't really get it from Elizabeth because she's sort of in denial and more worried about herself. But we get these asides from the gardeners because, you know, them saying, you know, like, oh, like, Wickham is, like, handsome and all, but, you know, Darcy's also kind of handsome. And they're, like, fishing, basically. They are trying to get information from Elizabeth. And then you have this mm-hmm. line in chapter 44 that I put little, like, heart emojis next to because I just love it so much. And they soon drew from these inquiries the full conviction that one of them at least knew what it was to love. Of the lady's sensations, they remained a little in doubt, but that the gentleman was overflowing with admiration was evident enough. Like, and these are, like, impartial sort of observers who just, like, came into the scene thinking that Darcy wasn't a great guy and that Elizabeth hated him. And within, like, less than a day, they're like, okay, like, they love each other.
They do. Yeah. There are, like, a reasonable audience voice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't come across in the adapt. Like, in the adaptions, you're still a little bit unclear. You know, you're like, mm-hmm. okay, Elizabeth is starting to like him and Darcy's being, like, a lot sweeter. But here in the book, you have characters that you trust to be impartial and good, and they're both saying, like, nope, they love each other, that's it.
And it's fun to have them there actually, like, kind of call it out, even though no one's saying it aloud, which is really fun. And at this meeting, you know, we see Darcy actually not just being, like, really polite and civil and courteous, he seems to be, like, actively trying to mm-hmm. win their approval.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So it's not like, so clearly he's not someone who sees their position or how they achieve their own, like, personal wealth as, even though he talked about, you know, propriety and all that stuff, especially since that they seem like reasonable people and that they clearly mean something to Elizabeth, is enough for him to be like, look, I want you to like me. I want you to like my sister. I want you to like everything that I have. Please take a look at it.
It's really, like, lovely, like, the change that Darcy makes and how much effort he's putting in and how, like, kind of flummoxed Elizabeth is, but at the same time how much she wants everybody to like her. And, like, Elizabeth on her side had so much to do. She wanted to ascertain the feelings of each of her visitors. She wanted to compose her own and to make herself agreeable to all. And in the latter object, which she feared most to fail, she was most sure of success, for those to whom she endeavored to give pleasure were repossessed in her favor. Bingley was ready, Georgiana was eager, and Darcy determined to please. So it's just, like, really lovely. Like, here she's, like, really nervous. She wants everyone to like her. And, you know, clearly Bingley, like, likes everybody, whatever. But it's clear that Darcy had told his sister, you know, I like this girl. Like, I want you to like her.
Yeah. And she's someone that you'll like, too.
Yeah. Oh, it's just really, I really like, yeah. The Georgiana is very sweet, and Elizabeth is very doting to her and recognizes that she's shy, and then Bingley's, like, fishing, you know, like, so are all your sisters still at Longbourn?
He's, like, trying to be sly about it, and then he makes a comment about, like, when's the last, you know, someone makes a comment about the last time they saw each other, and he starts, like, mentioning something, and then he's just like, oh, this was the exact date, it was at this moment, and I'm just like, he remembers when he last saw Jane to the date, he's been thinking about it.
Oh, it's so cute. And then they, like, invite them over to the house for tea, and Mrs. Gardner's like, an invitation to the house, what's going on there? And Elizabeth's like, nope, not giving you anything. And Mr. Garner's like, it's evident that she was much better acquainted with Mr. Darcy than they had any idea before. And it was evident that he was very much in love with her. They saw very much to interest, but nothing to justify inquiry. Which is just so lovely, because they, like, don't press her on it, even though, like, they explicitly say, like, it's no more in code anymore. It's not that just he admired her. It's that, like, nope, they know that Darcy's in love with her. It's love. They're not going to say anything.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not sure yet if, I mean, partly I think, like, you can make an argument that Elizabeth is trying to be just, like, have decorum about it and be, like, super chill. But I think she's also just kind of embarrassed about it to mm-hmm. be having the attention of this man who's actually, like, quite lovely and nice. And also, by the way, like, super handsome and rich.
Oh, yeah. No, it even says, like, it says full out that she's ashamed. Like, what, she certainly did not hate him. No, hatred had vanished long ago. And she has almost as long been ashamed of ever feeling a dislike against him that could be so called. So yeah, she feels, yeah, it explicitly says that she's embarrassed and sort of ashamed of how she previously felt towards him.
Can you imagine if this whole encounter or visit had happened with the Bennets instead of the Gardners?
Oh my God. It would be, I mean, I do still think that Darcy would be just as kind and polite to them. Mm-hmm. Because he's, like, trying to suck up and, you know, he's in love with the daughter. But the fact that it's the Gardeners is really sort of lovely because we have this respect that Elizabeth has for the Gardeners that she clearly doesn't have for her father and her mother. And so to mm-hmm. see Darcy so bend over backwards to make them happy and to accommodate them after she had just thought, like, oh, I wouldn't, if I was Mistress of Pemberley, I wouldn't have been able to invite them to my house. Like, to have this 180 in Darcy's feelings toward them and in accommodating them, I think is really important.
It really is. And I, like, I don't like the, you know, love of a good woman can change a bad man kind of trope.
No,
but I
yeah.
think they're managing to avoid it mm-hmm. because we heard in the beginning of the book from people who were very loyal to Darcy that, like, oh, no, I mean, like, he comes off as this way, but he's actually this person. And I think this is less like Darcy and his love for Elizabeth is changing. I think it just he's it's just allowing him to feel more comfortable showing this side of him because it's hard to distribute that among everyone that you meet, especially when you're so important to so many people and have so much that you could offer and be taken advantage of, like Bingley. And I love that this change is happening. Such a change in a man of so much pride, exciting, not only astonishment, but gratitude, for to love, ardent love, it must be attributed.
Oh, I love that sentence and that sentiment, because I completely agree. I think it's a crappy trope that a woman can change, like, a bad man. And I think the mm-hmm. difference here is that Darcy was never a bad man. Like, he was prideful and a jerk mm-hmm. and said, like, some things that he shouldn't have said. Like, who hasn't? You know, like, he's not a bad man. And no. the growth, like, happens because he sort of checks himself. Like, she calls him out. And he thinks to himself, like, if I'm to love her, then I need to sort of prove that I'm not, you know, I'm not what she first saw, which is different mm-hmm. than, like, I have to completely change myself, like, a 180. And this is in the same, like, group of chapters where we have the woman that raised him, Mrs. Reynolds, talking on and on about how good-natured he was. And so I think that you're right in that it avoids sort of the sliminess of that trope. And it's not a change necessarily, and it's not a change, it's growth, which, and there's a difference
because mm-hmm. He's not the kind of person who will easily show that side of him, but, like, he had to recognize, I gotta get my shit together and show this part of me, to show, because she's worth, you know, exposing that soft part of me. So I've got to show her, I gotta prove it to her by actually letting her in on this part that I don't let anyone else in on except for some of my closest friends.
Yeah, and she, when she rejected him, she did it in sort of, like, a cruel way, and he's able to mm-hmm. forgive that in her as well. You know, it's not like she's been, like, this paragon of, you know, virtue and acceptance and everything. Like, she, you know, she said a lot of mean things to him and hurt him, you know, because she listened to Wickham's point of view and basically, like, unfurled this, like, opened up these, like, really intense wounds of his, because it's upsetting when you're a 15-year-old sister. Or, like, is seduced and runs away with this dude.
Yeah,
so,
there was a trust there that got infringed mm-hmm. upon.
Yeah, so I think they're both growing here, mm-hmm. and they're both changing in so much as they are being a little bit more thoughtful and respectful.
Another thing I wanted to point out before we move on is that in this encounter, when we first meet Georgiana, Elizabeth is very keen to note that, like, there is literally nothing going on between Bingley and Georgiana.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, they're fine. No, yeah. They're nice. There's just, like, no chemistry. This is clearly not a thing. And this is how we, like, go into how Bingley is clearly still thinking about Jane, no matter what Caroline thinks or wants.
Yeah, it's an important thing for Elizabeth to see, and to just see how far Miss Bingley's, like, jealousy, like, really goes. And Miss Bingley just comes off very poorly in these chapters.
It's not a good look for her, no.
No.
And neither is the next chapter when they all go over to Pemberley to have tea with Georgiana and Caroline. And then it's just like the ladies.
Yeah.
It seems super awkward.
Yeah. No. Miss Bingley needs to sort of back off. She Rain needs to grow. Yeah.
It's like kind of embarrassing.
What is the line that Jane, for jealousy had not yet made her desperate and her attentions to Mr. Darcy were by no means over? Such a horrible sentence.
Thankfully, though, Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardiner are like are pretty aware of what's going on, and they see, you know, the Bingley sisters not really wanting to engage because they have their own sort of petty reasons that they can't get past. And Miss Darcy's manner to people who were already insecure could be seen as proud, but to Mrs. Gardiner and to Elizabeth, they could see how just like shy and socially anxious she was. So they like kind of keep the conversation going with Miss Ansley, who is like what, Georgiana's companion person, mm-hmm. not really someone who's supposed to be part of the conversation, but it's almost like they're all trying to protect Georgiana from an incredibly awkward moment that will just make her feel even more anxious, which I love.
I know, but I hate that scene like so much when in Darcy's presence she dare not mention Wickham's name, but Elizabeth instantly comprehended that she was he was upmost in her thoughts. While she spoke, an involuntary glance showed her Darcy with a heightened complexion, earnestly looking at her and his sister, overcome with confusion and unable to lift her eyes. Had Miss Bingley known what pain she was then giving her beloved friend, she undoubtedly would have refrained from the hint, but she had merely intended to discompose Elizabeth by bringing forward the idea of a man to whom she believed her partial, to make her betray a sensibility which might injure her in Darcy's opinion. Oh my god, this scene is so cringy.
I want to be mad at Caroline, and I am, but not as much as she probably deserves, because she doesn't actually know. And like it says, and like it's been pointed out before in the past, she is quite affectionate about Caroline, or about Georgiana. So many names that keep confusing them. It's almost worse that she doesn't know that she's causing someone so much pain.
Yeah, it's a... You know, I don't like Miss Bingley, but, like, remember early in the book, like, she comes up to Elizabeth and says, I just want to let you know, like, Wickham's a shady dude. I don't know exactly what happened, but he's not a good guy. So you even had, like, even though she's, like, jealous of Elizabeth, and she says a lot of very not nice things, and I don't like her, it's, like, clearly because she's jealous and a little bit desperate. You're right, that she doesn't know, like, it's not malicious, even though... us as the reader and Elizabeth herself are instantly aware of Georgiana being the one that would be most hurt in this situation.
And at least she knows better than to like lean into this train of thought that she's on and not to actually talk about Wickham in front of Darcy, because that's the line she doesn't want to cross, because she's trying to get with that. But afterwards, you know, Georgiana doesn't basically say anything for the rest of the conversation.
But you have like, but it makes Darcy even like Elizabeth more, because you have like a moment where like Miss Bingley gets to call out exactly like, what do you think about Wickham now? And Elizabeth does it perfectly. Like, she protects his sister, and Darcy's just sitting there worried about his sister, and then Elizabeth comes to her defense. So it's just like a perfect moment for Elizabeth to come out the hero, and for Miss Bingley to look worse in his estimation, even if she doesn't know all the details.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a good scene for that reason, even though it makes me like really uncomfortable, because I feel so bad for Georgiana.
So uncomfortable. It's a very good scene in that it's awful and that it hurts on the inside.
Yeah.
Possibly, and it's possibly worse than what happens after Elizabeth and the Gardiners leave.
Miss Bingley,
who's clearly getting real desperate. Like, she's not even... she's not even like hiding it now. It's
overcompensating.
Yes. So she, when Darcy, you know, is walking the others away, she, at some point she was like leaning out, and she was like almost suspending herself over the edge, just hanging on to the thing. Anyways. So, she's just trying to like plant ideas into Georgiana, who thankfully is like, has already had too much information, I'm sure, from Darcy to buy into it. But once Darcy comes back, like, Caroline can't even contain it. She even starts saying it to Darcy too. I must confess that I could never see any beauty in her. Her face is too thin. Her complexion has no brilliancy, and her features are not at all handsome. Her nose wants character. There's nothing marked in its lines. Her teeth are tolerable, but not out of the common way, which is interesting. And as for her eyes, which sometimes have been called so fine, might I note, by Darcy, I could never see anything extraordinary in them. They have a sharp, shrewish look, which I do not like at all. And in her air altogether, there's a self-sufficiency without fashion, which is intolerable. She is getting so desperate, y'all.
It's like watching, you know, like a train wreck, you know, just like something like go on and on and on, and you're just like, stop it, like stop it right now, you're like doing the exactly wrong thing, but she just like cannot stop.
I do, part of me wonders if she has that voice in her head while she's saying all these things going, what are you doing?
It's like in you know, in Mean Girls when she's like talking, like the word vomit, like she just like can't stop talking, like she knows it's like wrong and she knows it's stupid and she knows she like should stop, but you just like can't, like once you get started you're like, how ill she looks. Like, I've never in my life saw someone as altered. Oh, she's so brown and coarse. Ugh.
She's not so unaware mm-hmm. that she probably doesn't realize how much worse she's making it. She's reasonably intelligent.
Persuaded as Ms. Bingley was that Darcy admired Elizabeth, this was not in the best way of recommending herself, but angry people are not always wise, and in seeing him at least look somewhat nettled, she had all the success she expected. Oh, gosh. Ms. Bingley, stop. Just stop right now. Ugh. You know he likes her. Like, that's not the way to go about it.
I mean, who hasn't fallen for that trap before? But at the same time, please stop on behalf of any of us who have ever been in that position and just could not close her mouth.
But then our Darcy, he says, he sticks up for her. He's able to stick up for her. And he says, yes, replied Darcy, who could contain himself no longer. But that was only when I first knew her, for it's many months since I have considered her as one of the most handsome women in my acquaintance. Oh.
Oh, Darcy. And he just, like, very soundly, he just puts it to bed, like, this is what it is. I dig that.
And then he goes away. He, like, walks out. He went away. Miss Bingley was left to all the satisfaction of having forced him to say what gave no one any pain but herself.
You only shot yourself in the foot with that one.
Ugh. It's horrible, but it's also kind of lovely because he loves Elizabeth, and I like that line.
Because that's like what you want from someone who's into you, right? You want someone who will defend you.
Yeah, no, it's like a big moment.
And it's not like a weird egotistical, like more for himself kind of defense. It's just like, nah, she's great. That's all. And at the end, we have Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardner basically not talking about what they all know they know.
Oh, it's so great. They're like,
they talk of his sister, his friends, his house, his fruit, of everything but himself. Yet Elizabeth was longing to know what Mrs. Gardner thought of him, and Mrs. Gardner would have been highly gratified by her niece's beginning this subject. Just talk to each other.
I know, but they don't want to. They're both sort of like hedging.
It's okay. They know. Mm-hmm. That's all that matters. And I appreciate Mrs. Gardner's respect for boundaries.
That's true. Yeah, it's true. She's not, like, super nosy. And I guess, like, we wouldn't have much of a book if everyone was just, like, super communicative and honest with their feelings. That would be the end of the book.
Please talk to each other is, like, the title of every Jane Austen book ever.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, gosh, we talked, like, this is, like, so much in these chapters. Like,
so much. And it's so good. I think it's completely worthwhile.
Yeah, I think this is my favorite group of chapters that we've discussed, I think, this whole time. There's so much there.
There is a lot. And it's so fun, and it's so satisfying with everything that we've gotten up until now without actually having a conclusion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not the end yet. There's still more.
What do you have, though, for your Austen Burns?
Yes. Yeah, so I have two of them, I think. One is from chapter 41, when Wickham and Elizabeth are speaking sort of in riddles with each other, and it says, she saw that he wanted to engage her on the old subject of his grievances, and she was in no humor to indulge him.
That's how you know you've really lost someone's favor, when they don't even want to, like, pretend that they're playing nice.
He's like, I'm not in the mood to even just, like, indulge you. Like, I don't even want to, like, I can't even just, like, sit here and listen to it. It's so Bernie. And then my other one is in chapter 42, about in the portion of the book where it's about Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Bennet and their relationship. And the sentence is, to his wife he was very little otherwise indebted than as her ignorance and folly had contributed to his amusement. So it's basically saying the only reason he likes her now is because she's so silly that he can make fun of her.
Ugh. I'm just less satisfied now with Bennet Burns.
I know.
But he is really funny.
I know. It's really mean. Like, it's a mean burn, but it amused me.
When, what chapter is this? In chapter 43, when the Gardners and Elizabeth are talking to Mrs. Reynolds, the housekeeper of Pemberley, you know, she's going on and on about how amazing Darcy is. And she's talking about how no woman is good enough for him. And she, Elizabeth, is like, it is very much to his credit. I'm sure that you should think so, which she may or may not have said sarcastically. I say no more than the truth, and everyone will say that knows him, replied the other. Elizabeth thought this was going pretty far. And I love that line. Maybe just that's just how I read it, because of who I am as a person. But I thought it was really funny that she's just like, she listened with increasing astonishment as the housekeeper added, you know, and just kept talking more and more. I have never known a cross word from him in my life, and I have known him since he was 4 years old. Just Elizabeth's disbelief that this is true and the way she delivers it made me laugh a lot.
Oh, I love that. I think I like skipped over that in my first reading. So I think that's great.
I feel like I had another one, but now I don't see. Oh, you read this earlier. No, it's fine. When Elizabeth was trying to get out of visiting Pemberley, and she said that, like, after, you know, she must own that she was tired of seeing great houses after going over so many. She really had no pleasure in fine carpets or satin curtains.
Seen one, seen them all.
Just like a general burn of rich people. So it's been a really good group of chapters.
I know. I think we've gone on pretty long, but I think we're sort of in the end here. Next up are chapters 46 through 50, which hopefully we get more flirting between Elizabeth and Darcy.
All the flirting. Even baby Jessie wants some more flirting, I know. Obviously.
She's hungry, I think. But yeah, so what are you looking forward to in the upcoming chapters, other than flirting?
Ugh. What else do I need more than flirting? I think it's clear that there's still something that Bingley is still holding that torch for Jane. So mm-hmm. I'd like to see what happens there. I feel like this was enough comeuppance for Caroline. I don't really want to like drag it out or make her feel any worse, because yeah. Her embarrassing herself is sort of enough.
Mm-hmm.
We gotta find out what happens with Kitty.
Oh, yeah. Because
you know something's gonna happen. She's not smart when it comes to men.
Lydia. Both of them are, yeah.
I mean, yeah, Kitty too, I guess. Maybe Mary.
Yeah, there was definitely some foreshadowing, like, happening. Like, something's going to go down and brighten, clearly.
And will Mrs. Bennet finally be able to just relax?
Will her daughters get married?
Yeah. Will she finally be able to chill and just be like, all right, I've done everything I can do now. Got to take up knitting or something.
I'm gonna guess no, but that's a really nice, that's a nice want for her.
You know what? Just let her chill out. Bennett's got his books. She can have something else. What about you? What are you looking forward to?
Just like more flirting. I want more Darcy-Elizabeth banter. I want it. I want all of it. I'd like everyone to just, you know, communicate, but that might be asking a little bit too much.
We're talking about people here, real people.
Yeah, so no.
So no communication whatsoever.
None, absolutely none. At least three more miscommunications and...
possibly a letter.
Possibly another letter. Yeah, we can only hope.
Yeah. So, Jessie, where can people find us if they want to talk to us?
Yes, please talk to us. These are great chapters. We want to hear what you think. You can find us at thedailynightly.com. You can find us on Twitter at nightlypod and on Instagram at thedailynightly, where our very own Annie posts very funny memes about Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen. And you can email us at thedailynightly@gmail.com. And remember, Knightley is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y.
If you should feel so inclined, feel free to leave us a review on Apple Podcast Store. That's not right. Never mind. I don't know how podcasts work, apparently.
Yeah, review us. Anyway.
Please review us. We like 5 stars. We'll take 4.5. And we'll talk to you guys next time. Happy reading, guys.